The Pro Tools Expert Podcast with Mike Thornton, James Ivey, and Dan Cooper.
Welcome to the Pro Tools Expert Podcast number 311. It's March the 19th, 2018. I'm Mike Thornton.
I'm James Ivey.
And I'm Dan Cooper. Production Expert has teamed up with Pro Sound Effects to offer a one-off exclusive bundle deal, the Cinematic Sound Effects Bundle, combining three sound effects libraries by the masters of sound effects, Anne Krober and Alan Spletz, with an exclusive discount of over 30%. This bundle is totally exclusive to the Production Expert community, so get it before it's gone. We'll put a link in the podcast notes. And our second deal in modern vocal production, timing is everything. With that in mind, we are featuring this partner deal throughout March on the Time Alignment Software Vocal Line Project 3 until the end of March 2018. Synchro Arts are offering a 30% discount on all new licenses and upgrades, making their Vocal Line Project 3 available for the lowest price it's ever been in its 20-year history. Again, link in the podcast notes. And you can also check out the rest of our deals from our partners in the Partner Deals section of the Deals page.
Great. Okay, let's get straight on to talking points, and these are sponsored by our friends at Universal Audio. Thanks, Fab.
Good morning, children. This is Fab DuPont. The Pro Tools Expert Podcast talking points are brought to you with the support of Universal Audio.
Are you looking to get that big analog console sound from your in-the-box mix? Well, if you buy and register any new UAD2 DSP accelerator between January 1st and March 31st, that's coming up soon, ladies and gentlemen, 2018, you will get the world's most authentic Neve API, SSL and UA console emulation plugins for Mac and Windows to the value of up to $1,196 absolutely free as part of the UAD Classic Console plugin promotion. Click the link below in the podcast notes for more info.
Okay, first talking point, and this is one that I've sort of been watching sort of comments and both on Facebook and on our comments section of all our stories. And every time the sort of new version of Pro Tools came out, it'd be sort of mumbling about current, the upgrade price.
It's normally me.
Well, no, it's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people,
saying, it's much more expensive than it used to be. So I thought I'd actually do some digging and see whether that was true or not. And so I went all the way back to Pro Tools version 6, trawled through the internet, finding the information on what price the upgrades were from version to version for. So from 6 to the next paid upgrade, which was 6.4 to 6.7, etc., all the way through to version 11, which is the point at which Avid started the new upgrade and support plans. Then broke it down into years, so because sometimes there was more than one upgrade in the same year. So, for instance, in 2004, we had both a paid upgrade for 6.4 and 6.7. Then made sure that I was only using the prices that Avid charged when you were upgrading from the immediately previous version, because there were all sorts of offers to encourage you to keep up to date.
They do like to keep it complicated, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, in many respects, the new system has removed that complication. It's a fixed price every year. Thank you very much. And so the average figure for Pro Tools LE stroke standard, because, of course, at Pro Tools 9, we dropped LE and it became Pro Tools standard, the average price was $100.10, which, when you compare the upgrade plan option for the upgrade plan now of $99, in essence, to all intents and purposes, it's the same. Now, when it comes to HD, it's slightly more complicated. The average worked out at $259, but of course that was just Pro Tools upgrades. The for HD users, you can't separate the support from the upgrade plans. And so at the time when Avid was also very quietly offering support contracts, they were typically $400 a year, which makes it something more like $659 to include some support. And basically, Avid is charging $599. So again, to all intents and purposes, a very similar price, and in both cases, very slightly cheaper. What was your thoughts when you came across this?
I was incredibly surprised, if I'm totally honest. As someone who, I'll hold my hand up, was not a big fan of the rolling upgrade. What are we referring to it as?
Upgrade plans.
The upgrade plans. I thought it was going to work out more expensive, and you've clearly proved me wrong. I'm sorry, I got it wrong. There you go. Not words you'll hear very often.
I wasn't that surprised because I've been paying each time since Pro Tools 6 as well for the latest versions and all of that. So for several years, if I go all the way back, 2004, so 14 years or so. And I can't say that I've ever noticed that I'm paying more in the recent years compared to before. I tell a lie, 'cause I did go from LE to HDX, so HD software, and I noticed that difference when I was updating Pro Tools 10 to Pro Tools 11. That was, top of my head, £500, I think, for the...
It was 999. Well, 9 to 10 was 999.
9 to 10.
And then 10 to 11 was $599.
That's better. Yeah, that's right. I felt that one, I tell you. I wasn't surprised. I thought it would be what you've come up here with, Mike, because if it was clearly different, I think we would have heard otherwise a lot sooner from other people going, I've noticed that I'm spending an extra $300 a month, or not a month, a year, annually on Pro Tools updates. And
but we'd have heard that anyway.
That's what I mean.
From the piles of Avid haters that are out there.
And yes, we've got friends at dealers, you know, that deal Avid stuff, and they would have told us as well. Do you know what I mean? We would have found out some way at some point. So I wasn't surprised that the numbers are this close. But it's nice to actually see from Mike's independent Sherlock Holmesing here that this is the case, that really we're not actually any worse off. And if you look at what we're kind of getting now with this new, what I feel is a new trusted system, because we are getting quite nice features and things to come, hopefully over the year, from this this system, it's cool. It's promising. We can stop complaining about it now.
And the other interesting thing is that I noticed when Pro Tools 2018.3 came out, it's like, there's too many upgrades. Stop, stop, stop. And it's like, hang on. You complain when there aren't any upgrades or they don't come quick enough, and then you complain when they come
too frequently.
Regularly.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, thank you. Next. Especially as it was largely a bug fix update, which of course is the other thing that a lot of people complain about when Avid have been adding new features is, just fix the bugs. Well, there was a full bug, complete and utter bug fix.
Can't please everyone.
But there we go.
Yeah.
You can please some of the people, yada, 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 yeah, yada.
Indeed.
It'll be interesting in, let's say, another 3, 4, 5 years to refer back to this, won't it? When we're on Pro Tools 2022 or something.
No, you'll be on Pro Tools 2022.1, etc.
There we go. Yeah, just be interesting to refer back to this in the future and just remind ourselves of what it was like pre all this. You know,
well, thanks to the search feature on the site, we'll still be able to find it.
Find it quite easily, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the data got a lot easier closer to...
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, I mean, I've just started doing some research for a couple of articles that are a bit dated, should we say. And it's not easy going back sort of 10 years into internet archives and stuff. The most reliable, this just sounds ridiculous, the most reliable source I can find for any Avid stuff is Pro Tools Expert.
You know what's funny? I wrote an article on the Digi 003 or when was that? It was one of the Blast from the Past series,
yeah,
a year ago, whatever. And obviously I've got one, I haven't used it for a while. I thought I'll just read an article just to refresh my memory in case I've forgotten anything about it. And I got to the end of the article, I thought, that's a good article. Who wrote it? It's only Mike Thornton for SOS.
Yes, I remember doing that review. It was I hadn't got very much time, but yeah.
I think it was that review that sold it to me as well all those years ago.
Yeah, because I was fairly sceptical when it arrived, and the scepticism was blown out of the water.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Okay, so let's move on to our second talking point. And that is an article that Julian put together entitled, Do We Need to Look at the Packaging Our Gear Arrives In? And I have to say, this was one of those sorts of articles that I thought, yeah, it just never sort of always sort of mumbled when I've opened a packaging and it's full of those plastic worms and plastic bags and this, that, and the other.
I have to admit, I read this and went, amen, Julian.
Yeah. But interesting, I mean, this growing foam stuff, I mean, it's like, whoa.
Well, I think it's fairly well recognised that globally we have a serious issue with plastics.
Yes.
There's islands of the stuff floating around the Atlantic and the Pacific, and that can't be good. There are many and various brands that have claimed that their packaging is eco-friendly, is green, is whatever. One brand that I shan't name, but I know they listen, so they'll know, started off one of their first products, one of their claims to fame on it, if you like, was that the packaging was entirely green. When that product actually went into production, not so green, sadly, very foamy and plasticky. So it is obviously something that brands are aware of. It's a big box and a big tick they can make in the winning category. But I suspect there is... It is more expensive to be green, I suspect. I've never been involved in branding or packaging or anything like that. The only time I complain about it is when I get the gear and it's damaged.
I was going to say, but also, you've probably got the most experience of all of us around this virtual table in terms of opening cardboard boxes full of equipment.
But that is probably true. Yeah, and you'd be surprised the levels of variation involved. Fortunately, it does seem that what I'm going to refer to as styrofoam, you know, the stuff that's quite solid but breaks up into tiny, weeny little balls if you chip it or knock it or whatever.
Or your toddler gets hold of it.
Or your toddler gets hold of it. Or toddlers.
God. Yeah.
That does seem to be a thing of the past. In everything apart from TVs. If you buy a TV or a monitor, I guarantee they still come in that kind of styrofoamy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely with the TVs and monitors, I'll back you up there. But I've had a few units sent to me, hardware units for the studio for review, that were packaged up like a TV monitor, absolutely wedged full of that stuff.
Yeah, it's not good. It's really not good. I know it doesn't quite fall into the microbead category, which I know is something that cosmetics and stuff way beyond my pay grade gets involved with. But certainly that stuff breaks down to incredibly, incredibly small, gets everywhere, it's either positively or negatively charged, meaning that it sticks to everything. That stuff isn't good. Now, there are some brands that I know use eco foams, and they use stuff that has a shorter biodegradability half-life, if that's it's not the right term, but you know what I mean, hopefully. But I am surprised that no one is getting on board with kind of the eco foam stuff, the grow your own foam stuff. Even heavy duty papers and resin impregnated papers. Again, I know why they don't use it as standard. It's because one, it's probably more expensive, and two, it's definitely heavier, which increases on shipping costs.
Mm-hmm. We've got to remember what packaging is for, though. It's to make sure that our goods arrive to us safe and not broken or damaged in transit. And if things arrive to us a little bit broken, just a little bit, we would all as consumers go, what the hell? They don't care enough about getting the gear to us. And things would be sent back left, right and centre. And it's more expensive for a brand to take back said damaged unit, fix it, and then sell it back off as B stock than it is for them to send us stuff in overly packaged boxes and using God knows what to make sure that it gets to us safely. I've had some things turn up and it's like, pass the parcel, big box. Okay, so we've got a box. Oh, and inside that is another cardboard box. Inside that, there's four layers of bubble wrap. I'm waiting for the music to stop so I can get my lollipop. Let's keep going. There's then another cardboard box. You open that, then you actually get the branded box, and you open that branded box, and there's another cardboard box, and inside that is all this foam stuff, and then it's wrapped in plastic. And you know,
I think there's a different argument there, isn't there? There's the argument for the primary packaging material for the unit. Say you've bought a 19-inch rack unit from brand X. That unit you want to arrive in grade A, pristine condition. We all do. However, how many times does one of the cables, or say that device is shipped to the US, the UK and Europe, how many times does that device come with a different power kettle lead type thing, with a different plastic bag, with different tape holding it together? Surely they could all go into the same bag. And I know it's only little things, but little things add up to making big things.
I'm going to name two brands I think do fantastic with packaging. One of them, IK Multimedia. They use pretty much just cardboard and a little bit of foam, that styrofoam stuff. And the cardboard they use is really cheap and thin. Not this really thick corrugated stuff. And the second brand, with no surprise from the floor here, Tegler Audio. And you're probably going, but Dan, they send stuff to you in wooden crates.
Exactly.
Yes, they do. And guess what? I use two of them as furniture at the minute because they look stunning. and another one I've got in my tool shed, I use as a tool box. So I reuse them.
So recycled.
I'm upcycling.
Upcycling.
That's what the term is. I'm actually using them for a different purpose. And inside, you know, you get the rack unit and it doesn't have foam or styrofoam around these things. It has four corners of molded soft foam. And you know what? I've kept all of those little bits. So in a little plastic bag in my tool shed, in case I ever do need to transport one of these things again, I just will insert that back into those boxes. Mm. I can reuse the packaging box if I need to take this and take it somewhere else. Like I did recently when I moved house, I wrote an article about it. I was so grateful I still had this box that I've clearly kept because it's a lovely handcrafted item for me to transport my beloved Krem mastering processor, where everything else I binned or recycled. Sorry, I do recycle. I recycled all the other boxes for all my other hardware years ago. And I had to fashion plastic cases out of those little flip things you flip up and put your racks in and stuff. And that's how I did it. But I'm not saying that every brand should deliver their stuff in wooden crates. Of course not. I'm just saying that Tegler have thought a way of doing it. And it's quite smart. And if you think about it, microphones are quite a few microphones are, you know, sent to you in wooden boxes. And that becomes part of the package. But I do get wound up with some things that come through, and it is, as I said, like pass the parcel. Lots of different layers to get through and lots of recycling to do as well.
Well, all I can say is I hope more and more brands pick up on this and revise their packaging to be a lot more green, because certainly the Blue Planet 2 series was an eye-opener into the amount of plastic that was washing around in our oceans. I appreciate that not all plastic washing around from our oceans comes from packaging, but it is a contributing factor.
And it's a start. It's all very well saying, oh, it'll make no difference. Cobblers, of course it'll make a difference. If we all get on board with this, as an industry, if the audio industry says, right, do you know what? We're going to charge £1 more per unit, and we're not going to use any plastic packaging.
Hmm.
I don't know a single human being who's ever bought audio gear would go, oh, do you know what? Do you know, actually, I'd rather have the cheap packaging. I don't know anyone who would do it.
Do you know what? This reminds me of something. I think I spoke to Julian about this when he first came up with the idea for this article. It reminded me of this big old news that hit the supermarkets within the last 10 years. I can't tell you exactly when. But the supermarkets here in the UK, the big ones like Sainsbury's and Tesco and Asda, they got all of them got in trouble for things like their own branded sausages and meat products, saying there's way too much packaging on these. You know, for 8 sausages, you've got a massive plastic tray wrapped in this foil stuff, wrapped in cardboard box as well, wrapped in plastic again. And they all got told off and said, you've got to sort out your packaging. You've got to somehow make this, you know, better for the environment. Mm. Otherwise, people are throwing away a lot of packaging. And they all got wrapped on the knuckles. And from what I remember how that story turned out, was they all had to all fall in line with these regulations. And yeah, it sort of reminds me a little bit of that.
I think it's going to take the companies that are shifting large numbers of units. And I'm thinking Focusrite, Universal Audio, SE microphones. I mean, you know, that's just 3 that have sprung to mind that are putting out large numbers of boxes. Now, I think I can be fairly safe and say this, that I think Universal Audio and Focusrite are primarily in paper stroke cardboard based packaging.
I don't buy enough of it to.
The UAD card was when I received that.
There's a bit of foam in there just for padding and stuff, but it's primarily paper and cardboard packaging. I know some of the less expensive Focusrite, the little interfaces and things like that, do ship inside paper, papery cardboard, like the pressed out paper shape stuff that mold, like clamshell stuff.
Console 1 was in cardboard with a cardboard sleeve.
So people are, we can, as an industry, we can do it. It's the stuff that's being mass produced, I'm going to say it, in China, that's being then put into a generic carton that's being, wrapped in nice glossy outer film, but the actual carton itself is a generic net that is available from a Chinese OEM manufacturer. It's there. We've got to sort of get into this. You know, the lower end of the market, the mass, the large, higher volume stuff. That's where the problem is going to be. We have to start fixing it from the ground up, because the big boys like the Teglers and Universal Audio, Focusrite in their higher end stuff are already doing it. It needs to get down to the stuff where you're shipping a cable. A cable doesn't need to go into a plastic bag, into a jiffy bag, being wrapped up in shrink wrap. A cable needs to go into a jiffy bag or into, you know, to ship.
Yeah, or those security plastic things that you cannot open without a set of scissors.
Yeah.
I'm sick and tired of those things. They're an absolute pain.
Well, talking about Universal Audio, I just been into my cupboard and retrieved my Apollo Twin, which is I keep in its original packaging. It's lovely. Suction as you lift the cardboard box lid off. The Apollo Twin is sat there, and it is sat on some foam, I have to say. I don't know what sort of, what its green credentials are, but the box itself is certainly all cardboard, but there is a certain amount of foam that the machine is, the Apollo Twin is sitting in. So there's an actual example of a piece of UA
and again,
packaging.
And again, it's the lower end stuff that they're selling vast numbers of, like the Apollos, where we need to start. The foam, the paper and cardboard, yes, it's recyclable, it's reusable, it's it will have one of those kind of triangular arrow marks on it somewhere that means it can be recycled. I suspect the foam can't. So
foam maybe can be upcycled, though. If you're smart, if you're and you keep the foam, you can use it for things like the bottoms of drawers where if you want to put microphones, you know, we're going to use a drawer for a microphone locker. Keep your foam, use it as that. Saves you having to buy it, and B, you upcycled it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Whenever I, if I get a microphone that does come in that stuff, I normally take the foam, because it's normally shaped, isn't it, to the microphone?
Yeah, to suit the mic.
Yeah. I normally take it out of its box or whatever type of box it comes in, cut it to size so it trims it down, and then stick that inside one of my drawers, as Dan said.
Yeah.
So I've always got the same, the actual moulded slot to put the microphone in.
Yeah.
I know. No, I've done that with quite a few.
Cases. Yeah.
Yeah, I've done that with quite a few of my mics. I have them in these plastic suitcases that are also, have got, you know, shock mount, they're double layered. And inside, I've used the foam inserts that came with the mics to sit the mics in, and so that they travel well. But yeah, absolutely.
So that's a top tip for people out there. Just don't bin the foam, keep it, because you might have use for it. If you're going to keep the mic and you're going to have that for many years, you might change where you store that microphone. You might have a mic locker one day, or a mic drawer, or a mic flight case, or a mic whatever.
Rack drawers are, are particularly good for microphones.
Yeah, anything.
2 year rack drawers are all over my place.
Yeah.
Well, having solved the world's plastics problem.
<There you go.
laughs> Okay, let's move on to our community feedback, and these are sponsored by RSPE Audio Solutions.
The Pro Tools Expert Community Feedback is brought to you with the kind support of RSPE Audio Solutions. Great people and great prices.
There is finally an affordable way to get yourself some PMC Studio monitors. PMC's new Result 6 is the result of 26 years of painstaking development, bringing you PMC's patented technology and sound at an affordable price. Contact RSPE or visit the RSPE website using the link in the podcast notes to learn more about Result 6.
So, it's a longy but a goodie. This one in from Andy May, who says, "Hello, Pro Tools experts and the community as a whole. I'm a Welsh expat living in Canada, long-time listener to the podcast as far back as the Air Users blog days, and want to thank you for your commitment to the community. I recently upgraded from Pro Tools HD 2 to Pro Tools 2018 HDX, and I just felt I needed to share two things to the community. I inserted the HDX card, connected my new 1616 IO, installed Pro Tools and the HDX driver, and my Mac running High Sierra could see the HDX card, but said no driver was installed. I pondered and pondered for hours, and I wanted to do the accent so badly, but I didn't stop myself. Read articles on the net, deleted and reinstalled drivers, checked the HDX card was situated properly, seated properly, but no joy. So I called Avid Customer Support, or Customer Success as they were called for a while, who I'm delighted to say were excellent. We like to hear that. So, one, Avid Customer Support took details of my issue and advised me that a tech person would call me back. Within 5 minutes, I received an email from them detailing my issue and confirming that someone would call me back. The next morning, as in all fairness, when I called Avid Customer Support, it was during the evening, I received a call from a tech. I was not at home, so he emailed to ask me if I still needed support. I replied and said I was at work and inquired whether he could set up a time for a call, 5:30 p.m. He replied to my email and said, yes, that will be fine. So I got home, and at 5:30 on the dot, he called me. He logged into my Mac remotely, removed a file in the library called DigiKai, or DigiKai, deleted the driver and reinstalled it and got everything working. So, big shout out to Bo at Avid Customer Support. Hooray! Waves hands, jumps up and down. The second point, the reason that my Mac could not see the HD driver was due to a security setting in the OS, which would not allow the software to link to the driver or vice versa. So if anyone out there is doing the upgrade, go to System Preferences, -Security and Privacy, and allow the driver to be installed. It's probably basic to most of the community, and Bo told me he deals with this issue 10 times a day. So I thought I'd share this to save members of the community from wasting time going through the stress I did, when all I wanted to do was see the HDX and 2018 in action. Anyway, it's all working wonderfully. I lost a few plugins in the upgrade, but none I can't live without or purchase upgrades for. Now I need to find some online collaborators. Hello. Keep up the good work. And that's from Andy in Canada.
What a great story. I'll tell you what, that needs some nice graphics and it'll make a really good bedtime story for us pro audio guys. A nice ending to it.
Are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah,
then I'll begin.
Once upon a time.
No, we all hear way too often when, let's face it, when Avid either get it wrong or we think they've missed the mark. In this case, shout out to Avid and the team. Cracking work. Great job. Hurrah. Round of applause from
Hindu. Yeah, and he got his money's worth. He got support and he got it fixed. And he's up and running. And it doesn't matter if it's a simple problem or a difficult problem. You don't know when it's a problem. A problem is a problem. Hindsight will tell you if it was simple or not. But you don't know that until you're up and running. And if you've bought something like HDX, which is a sizable investment, you want to know that you're going to get some help getting it going. And he's got this and everyone's happy. Nice one, Andy. Thanks for sharing.
So let's move on to questions from the community.
Right, this one could be for you, Mike. Matthew Hollis. So I've been offered some old hardware from our studio at work, and we've had hardware upgrades. It's an Omni and a native card. I have seen some bits about a DigiLink license online, so I'm now a little worried if it will work or not. At home, I only use Logic Pro and Reason for composing and non-HD Pro Tools for mixing, post-production type jobs, video editing, etc. Do I need to worry about this license? Presumably, it will all work via Core Audio without a DigiLink license. But now after seeing the DigiLink stuff, I'm not so sure. Wondered if you had any experience with this. Matthew, we do. Mike.
Yes, this DigiLink license caused quite a lot of consternation when it was announced with Pro Tools 12.6. But to come back to the Core Audio, I have an HDX card, so I took the trouble to check, and it does appear as an option in the audio MIDI setup and the audio options in sound system preferences. So yes, your HD native system should be available to other software via Core Audio on a Mac. But coming back to the DigiLink license, the key thing with the DigiLink license is, firstly, yes, it only relates to the card. It effectively unlocks the DigiLink ports on the back of an Avid card. So whether that's the HD native card or the HD Thunderbolt box, which essentially is an HD native card inside a Thunderbolt adapter, or an HDX card. Now, essentially what happens if you bought Pro Tools post 12.6 and later is in that bundle of licenses on your iLock, if you bought a Pro Tools system with an Avid interface, you get the DigiLink license. But of course, if you already owned one pre 12.6, when you got the latest upgrade, Avid will have looked at your system and said, and basically anybody who pre-owned an Avid system was automatically given the DigiLink license at no cost when we did our upgrades at 12.6. So essentially, when it comes to DigiLink, the only people who need to pay the one-off $299 are people who choose to not buy an Avid interface to go on their HD system, but to buy a third-party interface to go with their Pro Tools HDX or HD native systems. So it's So it's only people who have since 12.6. So again, if you bought Pro Tools before 12.6, even if you're using a third-party third-party interface, it's not a problem because Avid will have given you and a DigiLink license when you upgraded. But for anybody who has since Pro Tools 12.6 bought an Avid system, which you can now buy without the interface, which of course you never could do pre 12.6, and that was the whole point, was to give people the option of being able to more easily use a third-party HD compatible interface. That's why they bought the Digilink license in at that point. So they effectively did yet another level of unbundling, and then just made sure that they got a little bit of money from a user who chose not to buy an Avid interface.
So, Mike, are you sitting comfortably?
Yes, this one is it comes in several chapters, I think we shall say.
I know we joked earlier, but this is genuinely the book at bedtime. And for those of you out there who aren't listening to Radio 4, you have
the home service. Or the home service.
Yeah, not all that old, Mike. So this is from David Harrison, who wants to be able to remotely collaborate with his cousin, who's running Pro Tools 8 and an 11-rack interface. He bought an Mbox interface with a free subscription to Cubase, which was not all that compatible to work with his cousin's Pro Tools system. We know that. And he has a series of questions. So we're going to take them one at a time, which is probably the best way to go. So, Mike, you're starter for 10. Again, anyone who doesn't watch British quiz shows.
University Challenge is what we're referring to.
Yes. Here we go.
You've got 30 seconds per question.
He wants to know if you can still use his Mbox interface and save the cost of buying an 11-rack interface.
Okay, David, unfortunately, you don't tell me which model of an Mbox you've bought. However, there's a slight problem. Even the most recent Mbox 3s now have some problems with the later versions of Pro Tools like 12 and 2018. And certainly the older Mboxes, the original Mbox, the Mbox 2, are very unlikely to work with current versions of Pro Tools. So that's the first one. It's if you got the latest version of Mbox, what's called the either third generation or Mbox, then it may work okay with Pro Tools 12 and now Pro Tools 2018, but it also may not.
Okay, I've started, so I'll finish. I'll keep these references coming. I'm working hard. He says, question two, I want to know how much it will cost me for a Pro Tools perpetual software and an iLock USB stick.
Okay, so if you go on the Avid website, Pro Tools 2018 is $599. And on the iLock site, a third generation iLock is $49.95.
Right, stay out of the black and in the red. Nothing for this game for two in a bed. And there's a really good one. What is the cost of an Avid 11-rack interface? How much larger is it than a laptop computer?
Okay, so Sweetwater at the moment in the US are running an offer on an 11-rack on its own, because most of the time the 11-rack actually usually comes bundled with software. More about that in a moment. For just $349.
What? No. Blimey, they were a grand.
Yeah. Click buy. Blimey.
That's a steal.
And now bear in mind that essentially the 11 rack has two very interesting factors to its name. One is it's the oldest current Avid interface, and I would almost argue any Avid hardware you might care to name, that is still a current product. Yep. For instance, the Avid Duet and Avid Quartet, which are still listed, are already end of life. They were end of life 18 months after they came out. The 11 rack has been around for over a decade.
Over 10 years.
Yeah,
10 years,
it's over a decade. So that's one option. But as you actually need some new Pro Tools software, because you haven't got any, David, if you go on the Avid website, and I'll put links in the podcast notes for all of these things, currently, Avid are selling currently the 11 rack with a copy of a perpetual license of Pro Tools for $699. So bearing in mind that Pro Tools 2018 is $599, you're effectively getting the 11 rack for $100.
And saving on the iLock.
No, because you'll need an iLock anyway.
Oh, doesn't it not come with an iLock?
It may do. I didn't read the fine print to see whether the iLock came or not.
Usually they do. Don't hold me. Hold on to that. But I wouldn't be surprised if there was one in there.
But of course, you originally asked whether it would be okay to use the M-Box. Now, there are a couple of things. Firstly, you having an M-Box or another interface and your cousin having an 11 rack in itself isn't a problem. Pro Tools is well used to taking a session that was created on one type of interface and opening it on another. You might need to have a brief chat with the I/O setup window, but again, Pro Tools now from 12 itself was a lot better in handling different interfaces.
It used to be a you-know-what, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But my concern for you is if you try and continue to use the M-Box and buy Pro Tools software at $599, it may not be a reliable solution for you, where for an extra $100, you can buy Pro Tools and an 11 rack, so you've got exactly the same interface as your cousin, and you've got the latest version of Pro Tools. Now, the other thing, of course, if you're shipping sessions back and forth between yourself and your cousin, if your cousin has actually got Pro Tools 8, then you may need to look at going in. When you send your cousin a session, you may need to have a visit to the Save Session Copy option and select there's a drop-down menu which allows you to change and set it to the version of Pro Tools that your cousin has got. So PTF. It may well be 7.129. Every so often the session format was changed, so it's just something you need to bear in mind. But other than that, you will have no troubles because essentially you've got exactly the same interface. And finally, in this little section, you asked how much larger is it than the laptop. Well, 11 rack is a rack mounted unit, so it's going to be 19 inches wide. It's 2U high, so it's going to be 3.5 inches high. And in fact, the 11 rack is 13.5 inches deep. A little bit. Well, it's obviously thicker than a laptop, but I mean, essentially, a laptop would sit quite nicely on top of it. Or
you can actually get, because I bought one, a soft rack bag, which then has a sleeve on the top for your laptop.
Even better. Cool.
And the company that made them at the time was a company called Gigskins.
Yeah.
And it had holes between the laptop compartment and the rack compartment, so you could leave all the cables permanently plumbed in.
Oh, very nice.
I was never brave enough because I just thought the laptop would be flying around inside the... anyway, but the idea was great.
Okay, so on to the last part of this one.
Question four is, or the fourth part of the question, is Pro Tools Perpetual and an 11-rack interface compatible with my Yamaha DMR502 electric drums and HP computer, which has an i5 processor and 6 megabytes of RAM? Hopefully that's 6 gigabytes of RAM.
Yes. I think an i5 processor with 6 mega RAM, no. But anyway, never mind.
Hopefully that's 6 gig. Yes, so the last one.
Indeed. So looking at the Avid for Pro Tools compatibility charts, and again we'll put a link to this in the show notes, under the minimum system requirements for Windows, Avid do list an i5 as the minimum requirements. i7 better, but i5 is okay, but with 16 gigabytes of RAM. So if you've only got 6 gig of RAM, you're going to need to get some more RAM, otherwise Pro Tools will not play nicely.
That might be a typo, though, because I can't imagine that an i5 would ship with only 6 gig of RAM.
Yeah. Okay.
I would have thought that it would ship with
8, 16,
yeah,
12.
Exactly.
It's
so that might
numbers.
Be a typo.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay,
16
so,
gigs of RAM.
But anyway, the key thing is 16 gig of RAM. But what you don't also tell us is what version of Windows OS you've got on your HP machine. For Pro Tools, again, to play nicely, it needs to be no earlier than Windows 7 64-bit. That's the Home, Premiere, Professional, or Ultimate editions. And obviously, it could be Windows 8 or it could be Windows 10. But again, check the minimum system requirements in the Avid compatibility documents. And as I say, we'll put a note, we'll put a link to that in the show notes.
And at the end of that round, you have scored 4 points with no passes.
Oh, that's a shame. I was going to say he's got a bullseye, so he wins the speedboat.
We could have won. Yeah. And again, lost on a very large proportion of the listeners.
Indeed.
Oh, Mike, I'm really sorry to do this again, but there's another question for you from Jim Johnston. Time to make up your points. Jim has read your article in Sound on Sound about measuring the delay in outboard gear. He says, I was curious, so followed your instructions with delay compensation on. I have delay of 4 samples with it off. I have delay of 83 milliseconds, scarily readable in milliseconds. Are my numbers so low because I'm running an HD system or that I'm using an Antelope interface? James, you might be able to speak to this. I'm just surprised the delay is so strikingly low. Please let me know.
Okay, there's an interesting thing about... the first thing to bear in mind is this only relates to using outboard gear. So this is where you're essentially using the interface in and outs, or outs and ins, perhaps, strictly speaking, as an insert point to bring a piece of hardware processing, like one of your Teglers, Dan,
yes,
or you know, a real 1176 or a warm equivalent or whatever it might be, into a Pro Tools session. So essentially, you're using the interface as an insert point. And Pro Tools on the interface window has the option of adjusting the latency, the delay, as a result of the round trip out of Pro Tools and back in to Pro Tools via the piece of hardware. Now, the reality is most pieces of hardware which are purely analog will have no real significant delay. So if you're measuring the delay of something that is essentially a piece of analog kit, there will be very little delay, which would explain why you have a very small delay there. The other thing that perhaps isn't as well known is that Pro Tools assumes in its calculations of round-trip latency in and out and back in from an interface for a hardware insert, that you're using an Avid interface. So it knows what the latency is through an Avid interface and does the appropriate calculations. Now, if you have a third-party HD interface, like an Antelope, the latency, the delay through the Antelope is almost certainly going to be different to the delay through an Avid badged interface. And so, and because of the way that the third-party interfaces work, more often than not, when you go into the I/O setups and what have you, Pro Tools thinks it's an HD I/O or whatever. There is no way of telling Pro Tools that actually it's got a third-party interface on it. And equally, there's no way of effectively Pro Tools adjusting its latency numbers to take into consideration that a third-party interface may well have a different amount of latency. So again, this is probably where the little differences can start to creep in. James, any other thoughts? You being an Antelope person?
I've not tried it with hardware, because obviously most of my hardware is happening in the analog domain anyway, because it's across the console. I would say if anything, and again, am I right in saying that buffer size will play something into this as well?
No, this is taking that out of the equation. Essentially, this is making sure that, because if you've got a piece of digital hardware that you're using, outboard hardware, that almost certainly will have a more significant amount, yes, of latency.
Like your Procasti, for instance.
And,
maybe.
Yeah, so you need to, if you don't want your return from the interface to be delayed and therefore we start to lose sync
phase
and all the rest,
yeah,
then you need, just as we can use delay compensation to delay for the latency going through plugins, we can effectively tell the delay compensation element of Pro Tools to compensate for the delay going out of Pro Tools via an interface through a piece of equipment and back again.
So I would assume, and again, this is a massive assumption because I don't know the numbers, but the silver-faced HDIOs, the HD Omni, the HD Maddy, that's slightly off topic with that one, but they're clocking on a bit now, aren't they, in age?
Yeah.
I would say...
10 years again.
Yeah, it must be getting on for 10 years. I would say that if he's got an Orion 32 HD, like I have, which is only a couple of 3 years old, in fact, not even two years old yet, I would hazard a guess that it would have faster converters in than those of a 10-year-old machine. Again, I could be jumping to huge assumptions, but I wouldn't have thought so. So actually, the numbers you're getting wouldn't surprise me in the slightest.
I think essentially that four samples, I mean, in theory, you should get no samples. I suspect that four samples is the difference between the latency of an Avid, say, 8x8 or 16x16 IO, and the latency of the Antelope. So again, I mean, four samples is just not worth even worrying about.
I just want to speak to this because if we've got some inexperienced guys listening to this and we're scaring the crap out of them, don't be, because I don't think these numbers are anything to worry about. And I don't think it'll get in the way of getting the job done in your studio. I mean, I was just going to say to James, you've got a sizable collection of outboard gear, and I know you use a lot of it a lot of the time, patching things in and out of Pro Tools through your desk. I know you do a lot of different ways of working, but I doubt you ever sit there going, oh God, is that thing 60 milliseconds off? Because I can hear it. Oh God, I just don't imagine that's you.
Those words have never come out of my mouth.
Exactly.
A bit like, oh, let me just boost 5K.
Yeah, you get on with it. So what I'm saying is if you hear a very audible little slap delay of sorts or something really not right, then that's when you investigate. I want to balance this a little bit because Jim's obviously talking here from, it feels like a quite a high up level. I just don't want the guys that aren't up there yet or close to be scared by these sort of things or thinking something to be worried about if they've got something in their rack going, oh God, what's the difference? Or should I be worried? Don't be. Get on your gear and make music.
A good thing to try is if you are worried about a return path coming through a piece of analog gear using real-time inserts through your hardware I/O, there's a good test. Duplicate the channel and then phase invert the duplication. If you can still hear, I mean, bypass all the processing, you will know you are bang on the money when you hear nothing. If you hear very, very low level noises, correcting for phase and all that sort of stuff is pretty scientific when you get down to it, but actually checking for phase is really easy. Duplicate the signal, invert it, run them at the same time. If you hear something, they're not 100% in phase. If you don't hear anything, they are bang on the money. They null out, they cancel out. So it's a good check. If you hear something, if you hear a little bit kind of technical description there.
But absolutely on the money.
Then the chance, we're going to refer to it as it's phasing, and it's pretty blimmin' close. Now, we all know the engineers and the super producers out there who would absolutely scream about that, and they would go in and they'll nudge things by the sample till they null out. And if you're that person, great, get on and do it. I'm not, personally.
I think to put it into context, the four samples is neither here nor there. The 83 milliseconds is
significant.
Is significant. I mean, when you consider that when you set up a phaser, the phaser plug-in, you're talking about delays of 10, 20, 30 milliseconds, and then flanges tend to be a little bit longer. So we're into the flanging zone, if you like. If you've got the original and the processed versions running together, it will sound like a flanger or a phaser. So that is significant. But as you say, that's the point when you have the delay, the figure you had when you turned the delay compensation off. And so, yes, obviously, then all bets are off, and that's why the delay compensation is there.
Well, there we go. You just got the technical description of my...
Yeah. Exactly. You have the analog version and the the techie version.
That sound effect pick is going to haunt one you, James, for the rest of your life. Morning, James.
it's actually from Monkey. Oh, blimey, there's some 80s TV references going in there.
Oh,
Monkey
yeah.
Magic.
Yeah.
Next time you ring me, you go, I've got a little bit of a problem in the studio. Or is it...
Quick, next!
The Pro Tools Expert podcast is created using Source Connect Now from Source Elements. Register now for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
If you've ever tried to do interviews over the internet with apps like Skype, you will know how hit and miss the audio quality and connection can be. Even on a good day, it really isn't good enough for a long-form interview. We now use Source Connect Now, which offers ISDN equivalent quality audio using a Chrome browser with no software to install. To get your free account, follow the link in the podcast notes down there. Do it now!
Okay, so let's move on to our find of the week, sponsored by UJAM.
UJAM Instruments plugins are your studio companions. Always on call when you want to write, play and record tracks. Take seat in the producer's chair and tell your player what you need. This means a maximum of musical and sonic integrity and versatility and a minimum of your precious energy required to get there. Discover our virtual instruments at ujam.com.
UJAM Instruments' innovative virtual drummer and virtual guitarist music production plugins are now available as AAX plugins for all Pro Tools users, so they can enjoy the simplicity and versatility of these instruments. Get what you need for your drummer or your guitarist in the minimum of time.
And a beer normally works.
Yeah, that works quite well. And again, as we often say during the podcast, there will be a link in the show notes. Okay, James, what's your find of the week?
Right, well, I haven't been on a podcast for a while, and the gear has been stacking up, excitably, and I was trying this baby out this week, and it's an absolute stunner. I have the new Neve 1073 DPX, a twin-channel mic pre and vintage-sounding EQ. Yum. Yummy.
I guess it's got to be a 1073, essentially, by the brand name, the brand and the model name.
It's a 1073 with a few extra bells and whistles, a digital I/O card, and it's just lovely. You know when you just put something in.
Is this the one that you saw at NAMM?
This is not the one I saw at NAMM. This is the one direct from AMS Neve.
Right, yes, of course, you're absolutely... Yeah, I was getting... Yes, my Neve's mixed up.
Easily done. But it's stunning. You know when you put something on, you put something in the chain, you think, I might notice it. Well, I noticed it. I really, really noticed it. It's one of those you don't need to... Get it right on the way in kind of devices. Mm. It just makes it sound amazing.
Better. Yeah.
Makes it sound better. You don't even need to use the makes it sound better button. Just makes it sound better. Yeah. Review to follow. Yum. Just yum.
Dan, what about you? What's your find of the week?
Oh, it's my find of the month. So it'll be my find of the week next week as well, because why not? I took delivery of a very cool little device last week. And if you took a glance at this thing, you'd think it was an Amazon Echo. No, it's not Alexa. It's the iZotope Spire Studio. Oh, it's absolutely brilliant. I got it out of the box, put it on my coffee table, made myself a cup of coffee and thought, right, this is going to take me 20 minutes, half hour to, you know, learn how to use. Nope. I literally understood how to use this thing and I still had half a cup of coffee left. It was that quick. Usually we get stuff in and we've got to read the manual page to page, do a bit of research on the internet, talk
to the
team. Who
are you? What have you done with Dan Cooper?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you see, I do my homework. But no, not this, not at all. I was basically just recording a song with my voice really quickly. It's an 8-track digital recorder. It's battery powered, stores everything you recall on the device. It's controllable via free Spire app. Oh God, it's so good. It really took me back to my early days.
It's the a 21st century Porter Studio.
Porter Studio.
Oh, God, it is so good. It's so good. Yeah, it's so good. And it's $350. What the hell? It's got a built-in microphone that sounds absolutely incredible. It's got a little sound check feature where you just hit that button, you play the loudest part of your track that you're going to do, and it sets the input level accordingly. I think there's some more witchcraft in this. It doesn't say it in any of the information, but somehow I think it could just be me being a bit blurry-eyed with it, but somehow it makes things sound very good on the way in. It's Isotope, you know what I mean? They have this sort of technology and things like Neutron, all of that. And the app, oh my God, the app is brilliant. I was quite hard on Neutron 2 when that was released in my review. I was sort of, you know, questioning the importance of the visual mixer in a plugin form, but in the Spire Studio, makes absolute sense. Wow. So review to follow shortly. I've already made it. My wife loves this device. She's a songwriter. And I've spoken to a few friends about this who are songwriters that don't like to use DAWs when they're writing songs, when they're in that creative mindset, because technology gets in the way when you're being creative. And if you're writing a song, you just want to get your ideas down quickly. And often it's the case, you get your guitar, you've got your lyrics that you've just got, and you put your iPhone down and you quickly throw things down on that, but the iPhone sound crap. And then if you've got an idea for a backing vocal, you can't really do anything with it. But with the Spire, you can just hit records and it makes a new track automatically. You've got your headphones on, it's done. Oh, I've got another idea for a track, it records. It's quick, it's fun, there's nothing technical about it at all. I could give this to one of my kids and say, make me an 8-track song, and they'd be back in half an hour and it would sound great. So yeah, look forward to the review. That should be out shortly, I believe, shouldn't it, Mike? And it's going to be my find of the week next week.
And it's currently the Isotope Spire is only available in the US, but yes, it is coming to other parts of the world presently. If you're not in the US and this unit appeals to you, then you don't have too long to wait. But that's all I'm allowed to say.
You're well worth the wait. Promise. Mike, what's your find of the week?
Mine is the latest update to Soundly. Now, Soundly is essentially a sound effects librarian software that works very nicely with Pro Tools and also gives you access to a huge library of sound effects online, as well as being able to access your own local library, in my case, some 50,000. So the new version, 2.1, has a more accurate search using their built-in sound effect Theosaurus. I think that's a brilliant idea because most of the team know that my typing usually has a lot of typos in. So, and also just thinking of, you know, you might, one of the problems with searching for sound effects is you might call it one thing and the people who created the sound effects call it something else. So this is a really neat little feature. New sample rate converter. So if the project you're working on is a different sample rate to the sound effects, then that's going to be a cleaner sound. And of course, because it's all tied in with pitch, you're going to have less pitching problems if you use the pitch controls in Soundly. And also for VR and ambisonics, Soundly now supports the ambisonic file format. If Soundly is all news to you, then we'll put a link in the show notes when I announce the release of version 2 and also shared my experiences and
thoughts about Soundly. But yeah, that's I'm very pleased to see even more updates to what is already my go-to when I'm hunting for sound effects, because you can quickly audition it. You can select a section of it and then drag it onto the Pro Tools timeline, and just that section comes in, which again saves so much faffing about. If you otherwise pulling in a 10-minute Atmos bed and all you want is 30 seconds, you just pull in a 30-second section of it and it's done. So on that piece of news, it's good night from me.
It's good night from me.
And it's good night from me.
Good night.